Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, an ongoing effort to share information that I feel is important but that generally does not get much attention within the mainstream media, and when it does, frequently is extremely biased. These are many different stories from many different points of view, all of which I feel give us some insight into the dynamics of the larger health issues involved in our day-to-day lives. Before we begin this, and I'm going to start with showing you the other side of the drug process of how a drug gets approved. If you think those drugs you've been taking are safe and effective, you may have a pause of concern after this. We are in the process of creating a forum to provide many different views to be shared on how to bring a healing to the WBAI and Pacifica crisis. This forum will continue on Monday of next week. And I'll be asking some very important questions. Now, if anyone in the audience has information that you feel is important, please share it with me. You can share it in confidence. It will not be attributed unless you choose to have it attributed. And already yesterday, over 60 people emailed me information that I was not aware of, because of their personal associations and working relationships with people who are on various sides of the issue. And one was extremely revealing, and documentation arrived early this morning. I'm very appreciative of that. Some people from both sides of the issue are now speaking out or sharing information because there is a healing forum, and they're concerned that information gets on the air. In addition, keep in mind that when I'm asking people questions, my job is not to challenge them for 20 minutes on a particular issue. It's to ask what I consider appropriate questions and then to go on. Remember, there will always be an opportunity to invite individuals back if additional comments, which are very germane, should be asked. And for those of you who have said, well, would you ask this question or that question? Many of your questions were extremely beneficial, and I thank you for sharing those. And when I do frequently a second round with people, I will have had a chance to sit and review the transcripts of the interviews and see where more questioning in specific areas could be done. One thing I do not like and will not do is a forum where everyone's on the same time. It's extremely counterproductive. People yelling over each other, and this is not television. You're hearing voices. Next week, I have six people on the show. I'm allocating each 10 minutes. Each will give them the same amount of time. Just imagine if I had two or three or four people trying to chime in at once. It's much better for people to take the time they have allocated and present their issues, either show what they consider the problem and their solutions. Then there'll be an opportunity to go back over those problems and issues with even more of a fine focus. And just in a healing process, think when you've injured yourself and there's been some deep sore abscess, you just don't wake up the next day and you're healed. It has to go through a whole process, and that's what we're doing. So be patient with the process. It is beginning. It is healthy. It's necessary. But I do encourage your input. I thank you very much for your comments. And all of your comments, no matter what they may be, are considered, and I value that input. Let us go now to the Los Angeles Times, the Associated Press. A scientific paper says drug firms knew diabetes drug called liver failure. Warner Lambert downplayed liver damage concerns as it sought U.S. government approval for its diabetes drug, Rezulin. The Los Angeles Times, a newspaper, reported Sunday. Warner Lambert assured the U.S. Food and Drug Administration the drug's risk was low While FDA officials gave the company inside information and favors at key points in the drug's development, the newspaper reported, citing previously unpublished company and government documents, the company knew at least 12 people suffered potentially life-threatening liver damage during clinical trials. In December of 1996, Warner Lambert's vice president for diabetes research, Dr. Randall Whitcomb, told the Endocrine and Metabolic Drugs Advisory Committee of the FDA incidences of damage were, quote, comparable to placebo in the studies, meaning placebo is an inert substance. In fact, 2.2% of the patients who took the drug had liver problems, compared with 0.6% who took the ineffective placebo pills. Quote, I don't think that these numbers are all that different, unquote, Whitcomb said in a recent deposition for several lawsuits brought against the company. The FDA approved the drug in January 1997. It garnered $2 billion in sales before it was withdrawn last spring, after being suspected of causing 391 deaths, including dozens involving liver damage. Well, the FDA spokesman Lawrence Bacharach said, quote, he was not in a position to comment on allegations concerning the conduct of the company or former FDA employees that were involved in the review of the drug. One more reason why we should keep suspect virtually everything the FDA says. It is utterly corrupted. And I am doing an in-depth white paper on this at this time. I've been working on it for 3 years. I have over 400 separate incidents where we can show and document conflict of interest. When the white paper is totally completed, which will be within the next 12 months, I will be asking for a congressional hearing. I will turn the report over to the Justice Department for possible prosecution, and I'll be trying to get this information before the American media. It is time to completely disassemble the FDA. If we want an objective, unbiased group of scientists to advise on whether a drug is safe or not, then we have to have an entirely new structure. The FDA is incapable of honoring the mandate it was given. It is nothing more than a police state for attacking alternative or complementary practitioners and healers and protecting the interest of the drug company, where most of the people end up going after they leave their tenure at the FDA. Recently, many of you were scared to death about vitamin C causing cancer. You think, my goodness, I've been taking vitamin C. Am I going to get cancer? Yes, no. Well, if you read the American media, you probably have stopped taking your vitamin C. How unfortunate. Not only does vitamin C not cause cancer, it helps prevent it. The truth can be painful, but a lie will kill you. And we have been given so many lies on this issue. In point of fact, there is nothing to fear with high dose of vitamin C. I have reviewed more than 10,000 studies on vitamin C and its efficacy in chemistry and its toxicology. And this was not a study done on human beings. It was not a study done on animals. It was a laboratory study in a test tube. Theoretical. Theoretical. When theory, you can put anything at risk. So do not be concerned about this. Let me give you just one person's assessment. This comes from Stephen Rosen. I'll quote it verbatim. They say that vitamin C can increase the risk of cancer. Oh, yes? And who's they? Vitamin C, cancer fear. High doses of vitamin C could increase the risk of cancer, scientists warn today, unquote. So begins the June 15, 2001 United Kingdom Daily Mail front page report outlining the work of Dr. Ian Blair, resident researcher at the University of Pennsylvania's Pharmacology Unit. The Mail headline appears to be in direct conflict with Dr. Blair's own statement, quote, and by the way, I have independently confirmed this, quote, this is what the actual scientist who did this test tube theory said, quote, absolutely, for God's sakes, don't say vitamin C causes cancer, unquote. Well, no. That wouldn't have made the headline, would it? That wouldn't have been on anyone's news. That wouldn't have gotten anyone's attention. That's like saying, for God's sakes, don't tell people that fiber causes constipation. For God's sakes, don't tell people that drinking water will cause dehydration. No, and we'd say, okay, so what? But so what doesn't make it into the news? So what doesn't scare people? So what can't be used as a tool? But who would use a tool? What would be the motive? Let me continue verbatim. The Mill and others were shamelessly done exactly that. To the less discerning reader, the story raises worrisome questions as to the wisdom of high levels of vitamin C supplementation. If those worldwide headlines have served any useful purpose at all, it has been to confirm the moral, intellectual void currently reigning in today's mass media so-called news departments. At a more fundamental level, why is Dr. Blair conducting tests on the efficacy of vitamin C at all? We're about to discover that certain parties have a very definite interest in casting aspersions upon vitamin C. Yet again, we are being taught what to think about a certain subject, but not how. To our knowledge, the information you're about to read has not been included in any of the latest and now worldwide, quote, vitamin C cancer scare headlines generated by Dr. Blair's findings. A golden rule. Dr. Blair postulates that high consumption of vitamin C, a most beneficial adjunct in non-toxic cancer recovery treatment, might cause human tissue degeneration, which in turn might lead to a heightened risk of contracting cancer. And it is here that we arrive at our first golden rule. When it comes to assessing the veracity of any scientific claim, we must always read between the lines and we must research for what the report does not say. We must especially be on the lookout for that hoary little chestnut, otherwise known as vested interest. A University of Manchester research methodology handbook contains the following valuable advice. Quote, science and research must be studied in the context of all the interested parties involved. The questions center on determining the relevant weight of the various allies in the so-called fact-creating process, e.g. funding bodies, businesses, departments of state, professions, and other scientists in analyzing scientific databases. One should always ask what social, institutional, political, and philosophical interests lie behind often apparently neutral and technical knowledge claims, unquote. That's according to the University of Manchester Institute of Science Technology Research Methodology course handout. On the matter of the fact creation process, renowned author John Le Carre recently added, quote, big pharmaceutical industries are engaged in the deliberate seduction of the medical profession, country by country, worldwide. It is spending a fortune on influencing, hiring, and purchasing academic judgment to a point where in a few years' time, if big pharma pharmaceuticals continue unchecked on its present happy path, unbought medical opinion will be hard to find. That was carried in The Nation by John Le Carre on April 9th. Bot? Question mark. With the above in mind, let's put Dr. Blair's University of Pennsylvania under the spotlight and see what encouragement Dr. Blair might have had in taking this extraordinary position and apparently misquoted position against vitamin C. We must ask the following questions. What big pharmaceutical interest might there be supporting the University of Pennsylvania Cancer Center and its mother ship, the University of Pennsylvania Health Service? What is the relative weight of the funding bodies? If the industry sponsorship is taking place, are the University of Pennsylvania Health Sciences personnel free to exercise unbiased critical thinking? Or are there grounds to suspect that the University of Pennsylvania's health science has been bought? That somewhere along the line, vested interests have, quote, purchased academic judgment. Before tackling the vitamin C issue itself, the following University of Pennsylvania Health Science general statistics are very revealing. Let's look at certain alliances. In May of 2000, Dr. Ian Blair's employers at the University of Pennsylvania received $26 million, a five-year core grant from the National Cancer Institute, the largest, most influential conventional cancer treatment institution in the world. In fact, University of Pennsylvania has been continuously funded by the National Cancer Institute core grant mechanism since the grant was created by the National Cancer Institute Act in 1970s. Currently, the University of Pennsylvania is awash with more than $100 million in cancer research funding. $37 million is from the National Cancer Institute, $43 million from closely affiliated organizations such as the National Institutes of Health, the organization which actually funded Dr. Blair's vitamin C research. Another $12 million from foundational support such as the American Cancer Society and the Leukemia Society, and $8 to $10 million from various pharmaceutical companies. Earlier in June of 1999, the University of Pennsylvania received a $4.5 million gift from the William Gates Foundation, that's Bill Gates, to research conventional treatments for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Why am I surprised that Bill only knows about conventional? Aside from Bill and Melinda Gates' connection, Oncolink, the University of Pennsylvania Cancer Center, is sponsored very generously by the following corporations: Amgen, the world's largest independent biotechnology company, Avenis, Ortho Biotech, Varian, Janssen Pharmaceuticals, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Upjohn Pharmaceuticals, and Pfizer Pharmaceuticals. These corporations are very big indeed, and their names represent no mean sponsorship committee. In March of 2001, the University of Pennsylvania Health Sciences announced a strategic alliance with Siemens Medical Systems. Under the terms of the purchasing agreement, the University of Pennsylvania Health Science will make an initial discounted purchase of cardiology, radiology, and radiation oncology equipment from Siemens, who will also service and maintain the biomedical equipment already in place at designed sites over the life of the agreement. In the year 2000, Siemens Medical Solutions, based in Islip, New Jersey, reported new orders of $5 billion. And they have 27,000 employees. Quote, "This is the kind of alliance that will be critical in our continuing financial recovery and the to assure our position as the leading national health system," unquote. That was Dr. Robert Martin, Chief Executive Officer, University of Pennsylvania's Health Science Division. A good relationship with Siemens may well be critical to the University of Pennsylvania Health Science recovery, but does this kind of dependent alliance foster the aforementioned necessary climate for critical thinking? What if there are privately held University of Pennsylvania Health Science reservations about the Siemens equipment, methodology, or ethos? Who will break rank first? Will anyone? What kind of commercially gagged framework are the University of Pennsylvania Health Science staff now locked into with Siemens? On April 26, 2001, the University of Pennsylvania announced a business partnership with Integral Pet Associates, the nation's leading operator of fixed-site positron emission tomography cancer scanners. A patient receiving a PET scan today is injected with a radiopharmaceutical such as FDG about 45 minutes before the scan, which takes about 2 hours. The radiopharmacological tracer emits signals, which are then picked up by the PET scanner. A computer reassembles the signals into recognizable images to determine if a cancer is spread, if a particular cancer treatment is effective, or if the patient is disease-free. It tells you that. The whole thing will now be seeking to supply major hospitals throughout Pennsylvania. Typical costs are $1.6 million in upfront capital per unit, plus $800,000 in yearly staff and operating cost. A short visit to the University of Pennsylvania Health Science website will not only confirm all the above information, but will also confirm that these alliances represent only a small percentage of the longstanding conventional friendships the University of Pennsylvania has fostered with big pharmaceuticals over the years. Given the strictly confidential source of the sponsorship monies received at the University of Pennsylvania Health Science, what chance will the following statements have of being allowed to feature on the University of Pennsylvania Health Science cancer information page? Quote, if I contracted a cancer, I would never go to a standard cancer treatment center. Cancer victims who live far from such centers have a chance, unquote. That was from Professor Charles Mathey, French cancer specialist. Quote, as a chemist trained to interpret data, it is incomprehensible to me that physicians can ignore the clear evidence that chemotherapy does much, much more harm than good, unquote. Dr. Alan Dixon, former president of the American Chemical Society. Quote, doctors are too busy to dig into the statistics of cancer treatments. They assume that what they are taught at school or what they is demonstrated in the pages of briefing journals is the best treatment. They cannot afford to suspect that these treatments are only the best for the pharmaceutical companies that influence their institutions of higher learning, unquote. Paul Winter, CanCell homepage. Quote, to the cancer establishment, a cancer patient is a profit center. The actual clinical and scientific evidence does not support the claims of the cancer industry. Conventional cancer treatments are in place as the law of the land because they pay, not heal, the best. Decades of the politics of cancer as usual have kept you from knowing this and will continue to do so unless you wake up to its reality. Unquote. Dr. Lee Calden, MD. Quote, almost every patient treated with interleukin-2 suffered fever, malaise, nausea or vomiting, diarrhea, sharp drops in blood pressure, skin rashes, breathing difficulties, liver abnormalities, and irregularities in blood chemistry. Rosenberg himself details a number of horrifying case histories, and one in particular where the administration of interleukin-2 had precipitated, amongst other things, vomiting, swollen joints, lung fluid, and vascular leak syndrome, where blood would ooze through the vessel's walls and collect under the skin, unquote. Steven Rosenberg in the writing in the Transformed Cell. By the way, interleukin-2, still used today. Quote, Dr. Linus Pauling, often known as the father of vitamin C and twice awarded the Nobel Prize, declared that large intakes of up to 10 grams of vitamin C each day aids anti-cancer activity within the body. Pauling was largely derided for making these declarations, but today large doses of vitamin C are used by many practitioners of cancer patients in nutritional therapy who believe Pauling was right and that the popular nutrient is indispensable to the body in its fight against cancer, unquote. Philip Day. In Credence Publication, quote, do not let either the medical authorities or the politicians mislead you. Find out what the facts are and make your own decisions about how to live a happy life and how to work for a better world, unquote, Linus Pauling. Now, the above remarks are representative of a vast library of well-sourced contrary information with sensibly questions of validity and efficacy of conventional cancer treatments based upon a huge amounts of clinical research and data. Naturally, with all these expensive and patented treatments available to fight cancer, the cancer rate should be going down. They are not. They are increasing. The University of Pennsylvania Health Science is totally locked into the conventional cancer framework, a framework which today rightly stands accused of achieving no measurable success at all in its approach to the treatment of cancer, immense success in causing widespread unnecessary death through its application of lethal and highly toxic pharmaceutical radiation treatments, and even greater success in rewarding itself absolutely staggering amounts of money in the whole grisly process. That these cancer corporations have become incredibly wealthy through their chemo-till-you-drop approach is a fact of life. That Glaxo, Welcome, Upjohn, Zeneca, and Siemens cannot deny. Pauling was right. We have been seriously misled. Taking the Siemens multi-million-dollar technology as an example, it may well detect certain forms of cancer, that I do not doubt, but upon detecting it, What then happens? Quite simply, a bewildered, obedient, grateful, and unsuspecting cancer sufferer is immediately directed towards the door marked iatrogenic illness and probable death. Closer examination of today's orthodox cancer treatments clearly reveals that the conventional path is fraught with toxic danger. But the CEO of the University of Pennsylvania Health Science has made it quite clear that, quote, the Siemens Alliance is critical to the financial security of the University of Pennsylvania Health Science Department, unquote. This is why we will hear no publicity, no public declarations of dissenting voices from the University of Pennsylvania Health Science as to the horrific realities associated with 20th and 21st century conventional cancer treatments. The corporate big boys must continue to flow in their money stream, and a handsome proportion of it will go into the coffers of the very dependent University of Pennsylvania Health Science Department, of course, quote, to assist in their financial recovery, unquote. So why the slur on vitamin C? As has already been stated, conventional cancer treatments represent a multi-billion dollar industry. These vast profits are fiercely protected by the industry giants. There are no clean hands in the pharmaceutical industry. None. But their treatments in no way address the underlying cause of cancer. Cancer is a nutritional, toxicological, environmental, and psychological condition which, in common to a great number of instances, can be successfully reversed through the application of sound lifestyle and holistic modalities. Linus Pauling, dubbed the father of vitamin C, sensibly promoted the benefits of consuming high dose of vitamin C in the preservation of life and the prevention of cancer. What we're dealing with are half-truths and lies. So why aren't we hearing about these natural cancer treatments and their successes? Why aren't they being heralded across the world? The answer is money. Despite the multitudinous successes in cancer regression through nutrition, lifestyle, and extensive application of vital elements, Big Pharmaceutical is doing all it can to silence these success stories, to have it become widely known that cancer can be successfully treated without toxic, profitable pharmaceuticals would be catastrophic for business. Who would continue to purchase these products? What would the Siemens, Glaxo, and Upjohn researchers and shareholders have to say about that? To their shame, vested interests are keeping well-proven non-toxic cancer treatments from the public domain. That is why, under Cancer Treatments, the University of Pennsylvania Health Science website has this to say about vitamin B17. Quote, several patients displayed symptoms of cyanide poisoning, including muscle weakness and impaired reflex, and had the life-threatening levels of cyanide in their blood. The researchers conclude that Laetrile is not effective as a cancer treatment and is harmful in some cases, unquote. But now read this contrary extract from a radio talk show featured in Philip Day's Cancer, Why We Are Still Dying to Know This. This was a radio host, Laura Lee. Quote, is it verifiable that vitamin B17, which is Laetrile, has any positive effects? Dr. Ralph Moss, quote, we are finding this and yet we in public affairs are told to issue statements to the exact opposite of what we are finding scientifically, unquote. At the time, Ralph Moss was former assistant director of public relations at Memorial Sloan Kettering, a leading American conventional cancer research facility. Of course, Laetrile or vitamin B17 is not approved by the FDA and will not be. What we have to understand is an effort to subvert this mass awakening to the horrors of conventional cancer treatments, a devious attack of an all genuinely beneficial and natural and therefore unpatentable anti-cancer modalities is now being waged by a rather worried conventional cancer establishment. The ever so gentle slur on our most vital of vitamins, namely vitamin C, will soon be extended to a wide range of essential minerals. This is just the beginning of a subtle but concerted attack against all vitamins, minerals, herbs, anything and every single modality imaginable under the next 2 years will come under attack. Do not be misled. The two University of Pennsylvania health science officials I spoke with regarding Dr. Blair's vitamin C report were extremely pleasant, open, and helpful, and displayed no intention to supply misleading information. But both persons were entirely locked into their superior's way of thinking. Media relations officers was curious as to my interest into who funded the vitamin C report. When I pointed out that if Dr. Blair's funding could be traced to a pharmaceutical company producing conventional cancer treatments, then the results would have to be very seriously questioned, this person said, "My goodness, that is a good question. I'll be right back to you," unquote. Her word-for-word courteous reply some 2 minutes later was followed as, quote, "You have me genuinely worried for a few minutes there, sir, but I am pleased to tell you that our funding came directly from the National Institutes of Health itself. I'm so relieved," unquote. Ho-hum. Long live vitamin C, and let us have more of it. Unquote. Steve Ransom. Thank you, Steve. For those of you who doubt that there is a major effort to suppress alternative therapies, let me share a story with you. One of the leading proponents of alternative cancer approaches, not holistic by any measure, was the immune augmentative therapy of Dr. Lawrence Burton. I had written the first article in any national publication. There had been a small one in the New York Magazine, but I wrote it where he got a lot of attention. And then gave that information to 60 Minutes. I met with 60 Minutes executive producers on this. Gave them my research file, gave them the story, pre-publication, so they had it all. And shortly thereafter, according to Burton and his wife and others, they were contacting him. And so suddenly Burton was major news. I had been to Burton's clinic several times. I had interviewed his patients. And I had approached the National Cancer Institute and the Pan American Health Organization and said, if you question that Burton is a quack, why don't you just take 100 of his patients who you have deemed terminally ill with no hope for survival more than 6 months and let him treat them? They're going to die. So if he's really a quack, let him prove he's a quack. But if he has something in his immune augmentative therapy, which is non-toxic, then it may be a breakthrough. They never responded. Indeed, Dr. Burton had been a superstar at the American Cancer Society's annual convention, a science reporters convention, which is where they present ideas of their so-called newest breakthroughs, just before these people go out and write all these great stories to ask us to raise money for them. And he and Dr. Friedman were able to shrink ascites tumors in a matter of moments. In under 2 hours, they were almost all shrunk. And the chief science writer for the American Cancer Society was Pat McGrady Sr. And he was the chief supporter and writer of all their news releases and very connected within the cancer community and very respected. And he had witnessed this, so he then brought him on board, and everybody was amazed, and they had been doing good research. He had published with his team over 60 papers in scientific journals, peer-reviewed journals. He was a leading oncologist, scientist, PhD, not an MD. He was working with Dr. Rotino at St. Vincent's Hospital, and Rotino himself was an outstanding cancer researcher and clinician. And the American Cancer Society was so impressed with his work that they actually had one of their own researchers, along with Sloan Kettering, join his team and actually had their name on authored papers. Kind of interesting, later on I would approach Cognam Woods, who was the chief inquisitor of the American Cancer Society, the man in the black robes who held the book of the destiny of people who could never get funding, never get any media attention, be considered pariah if their name ended up in the book of unproven management of cancer. Of course, there was nothing scientific about the book. It was a complete sham. It was a disgrace. Should never have been published. It was just demonic and despicable. And Cognon Woods has to be held personally accountable on a moral level for having caused what I consider enormous suffering of the individual clinicians who were cascaded and never looked upon with credibility once her name appeared in that book. But based upon the criteria of getting in the book, not one of the people I interviewed had any criteria for getting in the book. And yet many orthodox treatments and therapists did. So it was very arbitrary how you ended up in American Kansas's book. All, of course, in the name of protecting society from quackery. Well, legitimate credentials, New York University, legitimate published peer review, presenting before scientific groups, not interested in monetary gain, and sharing the information. Where was the quackery? There was none. Now, I pointed up something they omitted, that the American Cancer Society, one of its own people at the top level, made a deal to buy the therapy. Oh, yes, I had the correspondence. Well, that kind of surprised people. You know, it's kind of interesting when you're asking people questions and you have the truth and they don't know what you know, but you know what you know. So there was a campaign to immediately attack Burton. Instead of researching his material, they had to destroy it. And lo and behold, out of the White House came a report that Burton's clinic should be closed down because there was tainted blood that was infecting people with hepatitis. So overnight, the Ministry of Health and the Prime Minister in the Bahamas caused Burton's clinic to close. I had been in Europe at the time doing another story on Dr. Joseph Issels. When I got back, I had all these phone messages. In fact, they filled up my answering machine, of desperate people, and you should have heard their pleas. People who were at his clinic from around the world, and most from the United States, and they had gone there as last resort. People only went to Burton really because there was no other place to go and there was no other help. And I'd been for 5 days, so by the time I got this, I was 5 days out of the loop. And every single call was from different people from his clinic asking, was there anything I could do? Well, the first thing I did was I contacted the White House and tracked down who had made this report to reporters. And I questioned one of the commissioners of consumer affairs. And I asked, where's your evidence? What evidence? Well, it had none. It was hearsay. And it was finally tracked back to allegedly to Lester Maddox, former governor. And then spoke with Maddox, never told anybody any such thing. Then it was supposed to have come from some people in Oregon who had been contaminated and brought back some diseases. Contacted them. Their blood was clean. No problem there. So everywhere I looked, I could find no evidence, nor any evidence whatsoever, something that no journalist in America had taken time to do. They'd all bashed him, all trashed him. No one had looked for the facts. So this took me 2 days. When you're terminally ill and your medicines are stopped and they close down Burton's clinic, you're desperate. And there was about a person dying per day. And so I was working at ABC at the time, and I went to Mark Mason. And I said, Mark, I'm going to take a couple days here, and I'm going down to the Bahamas, and I'm going to report on a story there. And he said, fine. And I said, just back me up if there's any calls. And he said, fine. He was a real trooper. And then I called Leonard Steinman, one of the toughest lawyers. I mean, he's a piece of work. Brilliant intellect, religious scholar, passion for the truth, and always went after, you know, cases that seemed unwinnable. Tough as nails, in your face kind of guy. But he didn't do it for money, ever. It was always for principle. And he was a friend. So I said, I'm going to need you on this. And he, no trouble. I went down the morning. And I went to the clinic. I'd been there many times. And there was one car off to the side, and I wasn't sure whether it was Burton's or not. But I knocked on all the doors and knocked on the windows and was yelling around as I walked around the building. It was a relatively small building, maybe, I'm going to guess, 5 or 6,000 square feet, one story. And no one answered, and I couldn't hear any music or anything or anyone talking, so I assumed that there was no one there. And then I thought, where are the patients at? And I didn't know where any of the patients were. So I just figured, all right, common sense, if you've got terminal cancer and you're here, you're going to want to be as close to the clinic as possible because you're coming daily to get treated. So I just started walking in a circle, and it's real hot out. And I figured, all right, people got their doors open, and I'll just keep looking in each house I walk by because most were one story, and they had fences. I just looked through the fence and see if I could see anyone. And finally, after about a half hour, I came to a house, like an apartment, and I saw a bunch of people, and there was a person outside in this little lawn. I said, are you any of Dr. Burton's patients? And this person said, yes. And I said, well, can I meet with you? And the guy said, well, who are you? I said, I'm Gary Nall. I'm down here to do what I can to help. Well, you'd have been there to appreciate this. He ran into the house, and he said, Gary Nall's here. And I want to tell you, never have I seen that kind of reaction. And they were there because they were doing a death vigilance for a woman from Boston, an attorney who was there with her husband, who's also an attorney, and they were all desperate. Bert wouldn't treat him, wouldn't even speak with him. They closed down his clinic, and so I went in and I said, look, tell me what's going on. And I went over the woman and who was in the bed, and it was just stiflingly hot. And this woman smiled, and she said, you're going to get the clinic open? I said, I'm going to try. So I said, let's get organized. Where's Burton? And they didn't know. He hadn't been in communication. I said, all right, first thing we have to do is find Burton and start the whole program on. And they said, but the police, you know, come by there and they check the doors and they're hassling us. And I said, well, it doesn't matter what the police are doing. This is a corrupt little regime here. I said, I'll deal with them. And I said, just keep the faith. I said, I'll be back in a couple of hours. So I'm back over to the clinic. I said, what's Dr. Burton's car look like? Someone told me what the model was, and I went over, and sure enough, it was his car. So I again made a rounds of the house and or the clinic and knocked on all the doors, and still he wouldn't answer. So I broke a window. I went in and went in through the different rooms and went in his office. There he was, sitting there smoking a pipe, working on his computer. Oh, and he went ballistic on me. How dare you? I said, how dare I what, Lawrence? How dare I make you millions of dollars? How dare I make you famous? How dare I make you one of the most despicable human beings I've ever met in my life, one of the most selfish, contemptuous human beings? How dare I make you look like a decent person that you're not? Because of your special and unique qualities of helping people with cancer, you're suddenly given credit that you didn't earn as a human being. Is that what you're daring me for? Because you've got people out there who are more important than your ego. And I suggest that you start to owe up to being a human being and caring about them. You care about the money, you got a safe with $5 million in it. You care about being arrogant to people, but now these people, you're going to help me. He said, no, I'm not. I said, well, friend, you are. And I will not tell you what I said to him after that. But he looked at me, and he looked very strange. And I said, trust me, I suggest that you do something right here. And that something right is to honor the people who trusted in you and put their life in your hands. You owe them that. People mortgage their house to be here. People don't have a nickel. People are sitting over there in a room without an air conditioner. and they're dying, and you have the way of helping them. He's, well, I can't because, you know, they close me down and they'll find me or something. I said, no, they won't. I said, we're smarter than any government. What, you think these stupid little idiots here? I said, you let me take care of that. You just have, we'll come here tonight, starting at midnight. I said, go into town, buy some walkie-talkies, buy three walkie-talkies. We'll have one person stationed in here with binoculars, pick up some binoculars. We'll have other people stationed at the two blocks where police can come by, and I'll take care of the rest. So I ran out back over there, and I said, all right, you're all going to start getting your treatment tonight. They were happy. So we did it. Got them in. Took them in two or three at a time. And the deaths stopped. People felt inspired. So that was just two problems solved. The third problem was getting the clinic open. There's only one person who could do that. It was Prime Minister. Fortunately, through my contacts with immigration and with one person within the friendly person within the local media, I was able to get them to run a trace on who had been there recently. And I was able to track that down. I'll have to skip over part of this story, protect some sources. But I was able to determine that there had been someone representing the pharmaceutical industry in America who was down there and had done their little song and dance, and I won't go more than that, of what's necessary to convince a prime minister who, gee whiz, was just under a royal review for ending up with $3 million in his bank account that he said friends and supporters put in there because they liked him. Maybe they did. Who am I to judge that? But I had to find out where he was. He would not see me. And through a report, I found his social schedule. And so for 2 days, I waited. Then I got the word that he was going to be at a particular social event. I was there with my attorney. And I waited till he was leaving, he and a bodyguard. Then when he stepped in the elevator, I jumped in the elevator with him, as my attorney, and I took out the microphone, shoved it in his right in front of his face, and I said, is it true that you closed Dr. Lawrence Burton's clinic for, and then I won't tell you what I told him. And he looked at me, he says, no, no, no. And I says, well, I have evidence. And then I started reading him off the evidence that I had. And he just went ashen. And this bodyguard went to move between us. He had a gun. My lawyer went between him and said, I'm here, and you touch him, and there's nothing but trouble. And I said, I'm here, and I'm reporting this on ABC Network. Do you want this story to go this way? You've got a choice of it going one of two ways. I won't say what else I said, because that would be to reveal the information I had uncovered, but wonderful thing happened. A couple days later, Dr. Burton's clinic was found not to be a contagious place spreading disease and infected blood. And his clinic was open again. And many people were able to go there, not all healed, not all saved, but an awful lot. Now, I can't tell you how many times something similar to this has happened. Was the pharmaceutical industry involved? You bet. Do I know who? Yes, I do. Do I know the man who went there? Yes, I do. Do I know what he did? I absolutely do have independent confirmation. Could I do anything about it? Unfortunately not. Knowing something is not the same as proving it after the fact. But what it did, it let me watch this person very carefully over the years. And almost every time there was an attack, this person was one of the people behind the scenes leading the attack. The pharmaceutical industry, some of them are honest, some of them are not. The trouble is that there is a vicious campaign to protect people's proprietary interest in their lifestyle, their employment, their future, their savings. And there just is no ethic. And who gets lost in all this? The poor patients. The people who are suffering, who've trusted. From the White House to the American media, to the FDA, to the CDC, to the Pan American Health Organizations, one of the most corrupt organizations I've ever met, everyone participated in the unnecessary death of innocent people. So mine is a little different perspective. Been there, done that, still am, still doing. Just one little anecdote of life along the way. I'm Gary Noll. Next story. Listen carefully to this. I can promise you I know exactly where this is going. Mark my words on this. Within the next year, you will see wonderfully praising stories of the enormous gains made with vaccine for AIDS. Then you'll start seeing where it should really be mandatory to protect all Americans for their own good, to bring this terrible scourge to an end so Elizabeth Taylor and Sharon Stone and so many gays no longer have to wear those pink ribbons, and Tom Hanks doesn't have to do that either. It'll be for all of our good to have the AIDS vaccine. Everyone, from children on, thank God for the U.S. Public Health Service and the CDC and the UN, that wonderful bastion of objectivity and neutrality and openness, not the UN. What a godsend. And it's all a lie. You'll know that. And you'll also know that I will be in front of this battle. And I'll stand in front of that entire industry and I'll call them liars. And I will say prove, and I'll offer counterproof, that there is no AIDS vaccines, cannot be an AIDS vaccine because there is no HIV virus. And I'll say that the disease, the 30 diseases you're calling under one umbrella AIDS, you cannot prove that the so-called elusive virus can cause any of those. And if you can, show your proof. I will not be alone. I will have my documentary, which will be finished in the next month, and I'll have a special 3-hour screening. It's 3 hours long. It's powerful. It is a knock-your-socks-off documentary. And to make sure that no one thinks that there's any subjectivity in it, that it's not completely detailed and accurate, I've included a 1,300-page scientific reference and white paper to accompany it. I'm sending it to every reporter, every legislator of every government, state, local, and national in the United States when it's done. I'm going to allocate, and I hope I have a big selling book this year, because I'm going to be spending about $75,000 just on sending these tapes and manuscripts out and put it up on the email and get it out. So at least those of you who want the truth, because nothing the UN is telling you is the truth. And here's what they claim. Quote, this is according to John Hanchett, Gannett News Service. This is yesterday's paper. As the UN General Assembly gathers this week to forge a global plan dealing with the AIDS public health crisis, a group of medical privacy and vaccine safety advocates claims the government intends to make AIDS immunization mandatory for all Americans. At a news conference last week, a group called the Committee to Protect Medical Freedom released a 59-page research report titled, quote, If AIDS Doesn't Kill You, the AIDS Vaccine Will. The group also charged that federal health officials will employ computerized vaccine registries now in place in about half the states to track down children and adults not inoculated. The government, of course, denies it. Bill Hall, a spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services, said, quote, Health and Human Services is not aware of any such plan, unquote. Spokesman for the National Institutes of Health, which spent $232 million last year on AIDS immunization research said an AIDS vaccine license for safety and efficacy is maybe 2 years away. The AIDS Research Office at the National Institute of Health would not comment. The International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, which amassed a $230 million war chest, is the biggest private group seeking to coordinate global efforts. Its officials say mandatory vaccine is not on the horizon. There are no plans for that yet. Well, let me tell you, there are plans for this. They are interested in first spending this year $10 billion on AIDS research. $10 billion on AIDS research. And, of course, in the report that I saw at 2 o'clock this morning on the news, they said, oh, with thousands of people dying daily from AIDS, you could have fooled me. I thought they were dying of starvation, conflicts of civil war, tuberculosis, malaria, massive malnutrition, and chronic infection from all the above. The reporter claimed it was AIDS. Has a reporter ever been to Africa, 17 different countries, interviewed 2,000 people? I don't think so. No, I'm sure of it. So they think they're going to do an AIDS vaccine. Well, remember, they said that they weren't going to do an influenza vaccine, and they did. Did we have an influenza epidemic? No. But a lot of people got sick and died because of their vaccine under Gerald Ford. I will be bringing out my report before they bring out theirs. Hopefully, mine will get some attention and will allow everyone who cares about the truth to know that virtually everything you've been told about AIDS is a lie. And don't confuse the idea that people can get on the radio or television and be very passionate about wanting to save lives. I believe they're passionate, and I believe they want to save lives. I also believe that Janet Reno wanted to save the kids' lives at Waco. I'm Gary Nall. We all have different methods. I'll be back tomorrow, sharing more on the latest, including tomorrow, the shyness syndrome. Bashfulness is the latest trait to become a pathology. I'll show you why you better not let anyone know you're shy, or you end up on a drug. That's right, a drug. Now there's a pharmaceutical company that says it has a drug for shyness. More tomorrow. Have a nice day.